The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of the Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the October 25th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. The main stories and how they were covered. A GOP surrender ends debt ceiling crisis. What happened? Congressional lawmakers negotiated a last-minute plan to reopen the government and raise the debt ceiling this week, as the U.S. averted a historic default on its debts. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell agreed on a bill that would fund the government until January 15, 2014, and extend the debt ceiling through February 7th. It also created a bicameral negotiating committee tasked with developing a longer-term budget by December 13th to avoid a rerun of this month's crisis. The bill included a minor safeguard to ensure Obamacare recipients were being honest about their income, but did not fulfill the original Republican goals of defunding or delaying the health care law. The House was due to vote on the bill as the week went to press. McConnell said Republicans remained committed to repealing Obamacare, but conceded defeat for now. "This is far less than many of us hoped for, frankly," he said. House Speaker John Boehner said Republicans would shift tactics in their opposition to Obamacare, relying on aggressive oversight that highlights the law's massive flaws. But the focus will now move to forging a grand bargain between the two parties that preserves the level of spending cuts in the sequester through reforms to Social Security and Medicare. Corporate tax reforms will also be on the table. Senator Lindsey Graham said Republicans had squandered some of their leverage on spending and taxes in a doomed fight to uproot Obamacare. "This has been a really bad 2 weeks for the Republican Party," Graham said. What the editorial said. "At last, a glimmer of sanity," said the Washington Post. "After the madness of the past few weeks, the deal forged by Reid and McConnell opens the door to modest progress on the country's long-term spending issues. If Democrats and Republicans can agree to entitlement reforms that save enough money to restore needed spending on defense, education, and infrastructure, two birds will have been felled with one stone. The deal even has the potential to break the GOP's blackmail fever," said the New York Times. "The February debt ceiling increase will come just as many Republicans face midterm primaries, putting greater pressure on them to act responsibly." "What a debacle for the Republicans," said the Wall Street Journal. "GOP conservatives picked a goal they couldn't achieve in defunding Obamacare from one house of Congress, using means they couldn't sustain politically. President Obama called their bluff. Republicans can repair some of the damage by using the coming negotiations to reaffirm their strong, popular positions on lower spending and tax reform." What the columnist said. "The Republicans' total defeat is not just good for the Democrats," said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. "It's a victory for constitutional governance and the country, which cannot withstand endless crises and panics. Republicans have precisely nothing to show for nearly driving the country's economy into ruin, and in fact, now must contend with the disgust of big business and the rage of their base. Now that they see that playing chicken with Obama won't work, perhaps Republicans will stop playing." "Republicans would have won if they had stood firm," said Eric Erickson in RedState.com. "Instead, they threw in the towel, letting Obamacare go into effect and handing the president a major victory. True conservatives must now fund primary challengers to oust these cowards. If they refuse to fight for us, we must fight them." Sane Americans can sigh with relief for now, said David Frum in thedailybeast.com. But the bitter policy confrontations will continue. The two parties are locked into a new and more ruthless style of politics because America has entered an era of scarcity. In good economic times, it was possible to achieve a sustainable balance of high spending and relatively low taxes. The stagnant economy is forcing agonizing choices affecting millions of people. At the same time, many Americans are deeply uneasy about the national debt and rapid social and demographic change. Altogether, these factors make every political dispute seem acute, imminent, and zero sum. Brace yourself. There are more crises ahead. In our second main story, Obama cuts aid to Egypt. The Obama administration rebuked Egypt's ruling generals last week for their bloody crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood by suspending the delivery of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of military aid. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the U.S. would withhold several big-ticket items, including Apache helicopters and F-16 fighter jets, until Egypt made credible progress toward an inclusive, democratically elected civilian government. A spokesman for the Egyptian military, which toppled Islamist President Mohamed Morsi this summer, denounced the U.S. for abandoning Egypt as it fights a serious war against terror. But senior U.S. officials said much of the $1.5 billion annual aid package to Egypt would continue to flow, including support for Cairo's anti-terrorism and border control efforts. This punitive measure was long overdue, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. The junta has used U.S.-supplied guns to kill more than 1,000 Islamist demonstrators following its overthrow of Egypt's democratically elected president. This aid cut may not persuade the generals to change course, but it could help redeem the U.S. reputation as a champion of democracy. But at what cost, asked the Chicago Tribune. Every dollar the U.S. withholds from Egypt creates an opportunity for a long list of others who would relish greater influence on Cairo. Saudi Arabia's despots have already promised to make up any aid reduction, and the generals could start buying their weapons from China and Russia, who, unlike the U.S., won't lobby for the restoration of civilian rule. It's not clear that our $1.5 billion aid package ever gave us any real influence in Cairo anyway, said Michael Crowley in Time.com. It hasn't stopped the junta from slaughtering its opponents and ignoring Washington's request for restraint. If the generals now ease their crackdown, we'll know our aid dollars buy us leverage over the military, and that the program should continue. If they don't, it will confirm what many in Washington have long suspected, that we are just being taken advantage of. The controversy of the week. Obamacare. Too complex to work? 2 weeks into the age of Obamacare, said John Sununu in the Boston Globe, the program's constantly crashing healthcare.gov website serves as vivid proof of the bureaucratic program's crippling complexity. Despite spending 3 years and $600 million on setting up an online system, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has utterly failed the millions of people who have tried to get information or sign up. The bugs in the software may eventually get fixed, but not so the deeply flawed 2,000-page Affordable Care Act itself. To enroll a citizen in the program, said Gordon Krovitz in the Wall Street Journal, the website must first gather detailed income and other data from the applicant, combine it with eligibility data from dozens of state and federal agencies, and then offer a plan in compliance with 47 separate statutory provisions. It's that mind-numbing complexity, not glitchy software, that's Obamacare's fatal flaw. The admittedly inept rollout is not the end of the world, said Stephanie Minsimer in MotherJones.com. In 2006, both George W. Bush's Medicare Part D program for seniors and the Romney Care plan in Massachusetts, upon which the ACA is based, got off to starts just as chaotic as Obamacare's, if not worse. Romney Care's rollout was so bad that a full 2 months after launch, only 18,000 of the state's 300,000 eligible citizens had successfully navigated the enrollment process and signed up. Eventually, the kinks got worked out, and today 96% of Massachusetts residents have health insurance, more than in any other state. If Obamacare's engineers can debug the system by early December, this rocky debut will be forgotten. Even if Obamacare does end up working, said Christopher Conover in WeeklyStandard.com, there is still a gargantuan gap between what was promised and what is now being imposed. The fundamental lie at the heart of the ACA is that health insurance can be extended to tens of millions of people at no cost to taxpayers. Indeed, that the ACA will actually reduce deficits. The reality is that the law imposes about $1 trillion in new taxes over the next decade, mostly on employers, insurers, and individuals making more than $200,000 a year. Those costs will eventually get passed on to consumers. Another lie is that it won't be expensive to extend coverage to the uninsured, who currently cost taxpayers an average of about $1,000 per year in uncompensated care at emergency rooms. Give that person full coverage, and his consumption of health care will boom. Realistic projections are that taxpayers will pay $50 billion in additional cost every year. Don't be bamboozled by the frantic fictions of the right wing, said Bill Keller in the New York Times. Obamacare is exactly the kind of market-driven reformation that Republicans pretend to believe in, and it is already bringing down America's sky-high spending on health care. The law sets up robust competition on insurance exchanges and gives compelling financial incentives to doctors to emphasize preventive care and focus on patients' long-term health. In some regions, that's already brought about a 20% drop in ER visits and a 30% decline in hospital admissions. If Obamacare was really fatally flawed, why would conservatives be so suicidally intent on preventing it from taking full effect? Asked Anne Marie Cox in TheGuardian.com. Their great fear is that it won't be too long until the ACA isn't a new and scary socialist plot, but just part of American life, like those awful programs called Social Security and Medicare. It was a good week for animal attraction after wildlife experts in Guatemala revealed that they used the cologne Obsession for Men to lure jaguars to cameras planted in the jungle. The scent's creator said its musky odor sparks curiosity with humans and, apparently, animals. It was a good week for family trees, after Austrian scientists used DNA analysis to prove that 19 men currently living in the country's Tyrol region are related to Utsi the Iceman, whose 5,300-year-old body was found frozen in the Alps in 1991. It was a good week for rebranding, after the American League of Lobbyists changed its name to the Association of Government Relations Professionals. Everyone has that misconception that lobbyists are walking around with a pocket full of cash, said the group's president. It was a bad week for flying while fat, after 518-pound British man was forced to pay for two airplane seats to account for his extra heft, only to discover on boarding the plane that the seats were not side by side. One was in row 17 and the other in row 19, said Les Price, age 43. It was a bad week for vows of poverty after a German Catholic bishop was summoned to Rome to discuss why he spent $42 million on a new residence and flew business class to India to visit the poor. Franz Peter Tebarts van Elst denied that he has a pompous lifestyle. It was a bad week for Googling after Massachusetts police seized a computer belonging to a suspected bank robber, Sarah McLeod, and allegedly discovered it had been used for web searches that included "What happens if you rob a bank?" and "If you're going to rob a bank." The briefing section this week is an article titled "Trouble in Boomtown." North Dakota is in the midst of an oil boom that has generated enormous wealth and some big problems, too. When did the boom begin? About 7 years ago. Geologists have known about the Bakken Shale Foundation, one of the largest oil and natural gas deposits in the world, since the early 1950s. But oil production in the state was slow to develop because it was too difficult and costly to get at the deposits, which are trapped between compressed layers of rock. But as oil prices rose and hydraulic fracturing technology advanced in the 2000s, tapping the ocean of crude suddenly made good economic sense. North Dakota went from being the ninth biggest oil-producing state in 2006 to the second today, with only Texas producing more. There are now more than 9,000 active wells in the state, producing 800,000 barrels of oil a day, about 11% of the country's overall production. What has that brought to North Dakota? Jobs, money, and people. The state now has the lowest unemployment rate in the country, at 3%. Its oil industry employs almost 41,000 people, plus 18,000 jobs in peripheral industries. For those working in the oil patch in the western part of the state, the average annual salary is $112,462. The only requirements to find work are a government-issued ID and a clean criminal record. This modern gold rush has lured people from all over America to North Dakota, once one of the country's most sparsely populated states. Terry Ayers drove to Williston in 2011 from Spokane and got an oil job within hours of arriving, earning around three times what he had been making before. "It's a zoo," he said then. "It's crazy what's going on around here." Has that been good for the state? For the economy, it's been terrific. The estimated $34.4 billion North Dakota has reaped in revenue from the boom has given it the healthiest balance sheet in the country, with an enviable $1.6 billion budget surplus. But the flood of money in new residents has also caused some severe growing pains. North Dakota's population leaped 7.7% in 6 years. Some small towns have been inundated with new residents. Watford City, for example, went from 1,744 residents to 7,500, including 28 registered sex offenders. The state's infrastructure is buckling under the strain. Housing has become scarce and expensive. Heavy truck traffic has put a strain on the state's roads and bridges, which need an additional $350 million a year for upkeep. Sewage plants are running over capacity due to new residents and a flood of fracking wastewater. The region's health care providers are being overwhelmed by scores of workers injured while carrying out the dangerous manual jobs. "My work has now been transformed from that of a small family practitioner to basically an ER doc," said Gary Ramage, a physician at McKenzie County Hospital. Who are these new residents? Most are single young men lured from other states by the promise of big paychecks. They've transformed once sleepy small towns, peeling off wads of bills to spend in local bars and strip clubs, and in some cases, on methamphetamines and prostitutes. Williston's population has doubled since 2010, from 15,000 to over 30,000. Most of these workers live in temporary housing known locally as man camps, rows of trailers with communal cafeterias and bathrooms, not unlike a military camp. There are 17 man camps in Williston alone. To cut down on fighting and crime, the oil companies now enforce strict rules on man camp residents, with a zero-tolerance policy for drugs, alcohol, and firearms. I look at man camps as being somewhat a necessary evil, said E. Ward Kozer, president of the Williston City Commission. What do longtime North Dakotans think? They welcome the infusion of money, but not what comes with it. The cost of living has surged. Stores and restaurants have raised prices so they can pay wages of up to $20 an hour to compete with the high-paying oil jobs. High housing demand and skyrocketing rents across the state have also pushed thousands into the streets, including many newcomers who failed to keep jobs. Homelessness in North Dakota has almost tripled since 2010. In Williston, the Salvation Army has resorted to buying homeless men one-way bus tickets. Sometimes they're better off going back home, said Salvation Army employee Joshua Stansberry. Can the state adjust to the boom? County legislatures are clamoring for the state to spend some of its budget surplus on new hospitals, infrastructure, and affordable housing. But many state lawmakers remember how quickly oil fortunes can come and go. The state's oil industry tanked after oil prices collapsed in the 1990s, leaving many western counties still paying off debts run up during the 1980s boom. If the current boom ends for some unforeseen reason, state officials fear they'll wind up with empty medical centers, unused freeways, and empty housing developments. When Mr. Bakken comes to town, no one can prepare, said Brad Beckedahl, vice president of the Bismarck City Commission. It's a good challenge to have, and there's a lot of people that wish they had it, but it's a challenge. In our best columns of the week, the first one raises the question, who gave the parks to Obama? It's by Mark Stein at nationalreview.com. National parks belong to the people, not the government, said Mark Stein. But during the so-called shutdown that left 83% of the government carrying on as usual, President Obama ordered his paramilitaries in the National Park Service to lock down Americans' canyons, glaciers, war memorials, and historic sites. The point, of course, was to portray the shutdown as a crippling and tragic event. So Obama's armed Park Service goons barred the public from having any access even to open-air, unfenced sites across the country, beginning with the war memorials on the National Mall. That's to say, stone monuments on pieces of grass under blue sky. NPS agents closed a stretch of highway that allowed a view of Mount Rushmore. A group of foreign seniors were held under house arrest in Yellowstone Park, forbidden from the illegal recreation of taking photos. Excuse me, but it's not King Barack's land. Public land belongs to the citizens, and his most groveling and unworthy subjects shouldn't require a dispensation by his benign majesty to set foot on it. Tea partiers reveal their true colors. from Brian Beutler at Salon.com. For a vivid picture of the true nature of the Tea Party, said Brian Beutler, consider the rally it staged at the National Mall last weekend. A few hundred furious truckers and veterans allied with the Tea Party rallied outside the World War II Memorial and the White House to denounce Obamacare and the president in what conservative media initially described as a game-changing event, because it supposedly represented a popular uprising by the American people. But then the Don't Tread on Me flags were joined by a large Confederate flag, which its bearers waved outside the gates of the home where the first black president and his family live. One Tea Party leader, Freedom Watch founder Larry Klayman, said in a speech that the U.S. is ruled by a president who bows down to Allah, and called on Americans to rebel and demand that Obama put the Quran down and leave the White House with his hands up. Fellow speakers Sarah Palin and Senators Ted Cruz and Mike Lee apparently saw nothing wrong with this lunatic rhetoric and cheered the Tea Partiers' noble cause on. So this is why the GOP held the nation hostage, to appease a small group of menacing neo-Confederate fantasists. From Brett Stevens at the Wall Street Journal, proof that America is still great. Anyone who thinks America's best days are behind us should take a look at the Nobel Prize Hall, said Brett Stevens. While our politicians have been locked in paralysis in Washington, D.C., and a general air of America in decline gloom has spread across the globe, our scientists and economists have continued to scoop up Nobel Prizes at a staggering rate. This year alone, native-born and immigrant Americans took home 9 of the prestigious awards. China, with 1.3 billion people, has produced a grand total of 9 winners in its entire history. Since 2000, Americans have won 21 of the 37 physics prizes, 18 of the 33 medicine prizes, 22 of the 33 chemistry prizes, and an amazing 27 of the 30 economics prizes. Not bad, considering our nonstop anxiety about failing schools and our mediocre international test scores. The secret of America's Nobel sauce? Our thriving immigrant culture, our superb private university system, and our culture of individualism and ingrained respect for against-the-grain thinking. Our politics may be a mess, but the heart of American greatness beats on. The topic for our last word article this week is the Loch Ness Monster. Nessie's starring role. The Loch Ness Monster was born not in Scotland, said Daniel Loxton, but in Hollywood. Of all the real monsters that stir the Western imagination, there are few so romantic as the Loch Ness Monster. I'm not even slightly immune to that romance. My love affair with Nessie blossomed early and strongly. What could be more wonderful than the idea that a living plesiosaur might slide undetected through the frigid waters of a Scottish lake? I studied the famous cases, marveled at the amazing photographs of arching necks and underwater flippers, and absorbed the standard arguments. Loch Ness is connected to the sea through underwater tunnels, I told my classmates at recess. I was unaware that the surface of Loch Ness is more than 50 feet above sea level. Do you know why Nessie wasn't reported until 1933? I asked on the playground. Because that's when they finally built the road beside the loch. I now know that the road predates Nessie by more than a century. Years later, my love of these wonderful stories led me to the skeptical literature. Eventually, I found myself a magazine writer, which offered me the professional opportunity to pursue my childhood dreams of investigating monster mysteries. And so, it is with great pleasure that I turn now to the enduring mystery of the Loch Ness Monster. Loch Ness is a long, deep lake that lies on a geological fault line. A country-spanning cleft called the Great Glen, bisecting Scotland from coast to coast. The Great Glen features several large lakes, of which Loch Ness is the largest. At 22 miles long and around 754 feet maximum depth, Loch Ness is the United Kingdom's largest body of fresh water. Since 1822, Loch Ness has been part of a shipping channel called the Caledonian Canal. Composed of a series of canals, locks, and natural lakes, the Caledonian Canal allows ships to cross Scotland from coast to coast. Thus, Loch Ness has been busy and well-traveled for almost 200 years. Indeed, Loch Ness was well-used and well-populated even before the construction of the canal, crossed for centuries by boats and bordered by roads, towns, villages, and the sizable city of Inverness. As we look toward the emergence of the Loch Ness Monster in the 1930s, it is important to understand that a teeming menagerie of water-based supernatural creatures had already lived for centuries in Scottish folklore. Scotland's feared folkloric monsters include the Boobry, a giant carnivorous waterfowl, the Bowrachoi, a nine-eyed eel that twists its body into a shackle around the feet of prey, the Beast na Sorogaeg, a clumsy one-horned water beast with vast legs, and even the 12-legged Big Beast of Lough Awe. Among this horde of folkloric creatures are the widespread traditions of Kelpies, associated with running water, water bulls, and water horses, each use which haunted lochs and the sea. Today, these related but distinct mythological creatures are harnessed in service of the legend of the Loch Ness Monster. But there are strong reasons to think that this linkage is inappropriate. First, none of these creatures is anything like the modern Loch Ness cryptid, a term for a creature that may or may not exist. Second, none of them is indigenous to Loch Ness. In Scottish folklore, water bulls are small black bulls that are encountered when they venture onto land. They sometimes breed with terrestrial cattle before returning to the water. Water horses are lethal, shape-shifting demons. They are likewise encountered on land in the form of ordinary-looking horses, often with weeds in their manes and wet-looking adhesive skin. If anyone is foolish enough to climb onto the back of a water horse, he or she will become stuck in place, and the water horse will carry the rider screaming into the water. Water horses can be identified with modern cryptids only by badly distorting Scottish folklore. They do not act like or resemble Nessie in any meaningful respect. Moreover, they are part of a global folklore and have no unique association with Loch Ness. Water horses are said to lurk in most of the bodies of water in Scotland, nor are they restricted to the United Kingdom. According to folklorist Michael Muirger, water horses are very widespread. The British Isles, Scandinavia, Siberian Russia, France, Italy, Czechoslovakia, and the southern Slavic countries. In 1933, reporter Alex Campbell heard that his friends Aldi and John McKay had spotted something in the water while driving along the shore of Loch Ness. Campbell wrote the story for the Inverness Courier. Loch Ness has for generations been credited with being the home of a fearsome-looking monster, but somehow or other, the water kelpie, as this legendary creature is called, has always been regarded as a myth, if not a joke. Now, however, comes the news that the beast has been seen once more, for, on Friday of last week, a well-known businessman who lives in Inverness and his wife were startled to see a tremendous upheaval on the loch, which previously had been as calm as the proverbial mill pond. There, the creature disported itself, rolling and plunging for fully a minute, its body resembling that of a whale, and the water cascading and churning like a simmering cauldron. Soon, however, it disappeared in a boiling mass of foam. Presto, Loch Ness was home to a fearsome-looking monster, and suddenly had been for generations. Between the Great Depression and the rise of Nazi Germany, media audiences were ready for a diverting popular mystery. The centuries-old folklore traditions of water horses and sea serpents had the potential to supply such a mystery. But something more was needed, a catalyst. Hollywood supplied the perfect catalyst at the perfect time. The gigantic, long-necked water monster depicted in King Kong, and again in Son of Kong, later in 1933. I am not the first researcher to draw a connection between Nessie and King Kong, but I think that a stronger relationship between the film and the myth can be asserted than has usually been argued in the past. In essence, that King Kong directly inspired the Loch Ness Monster. King Kong opened in London on April 10, 1933, just 4 days before Aldi MacKay's sighting of the disturbance in Loch Ness. The film was an instant box office smash. Thousands are being turned away from Kong, reported the Daily Express. Those who didn't make it into the packed theaters came out white and breathing heavily. It was a sensation, a monster thriller so real and so terrifying that moviegoers cried out in their seats. A very few vague sightings followed the MacKay's story over the summer of 1933, but those first small embers of popular belief were fading. And then, in August, the legend suddenly burst into incandescence, and the influence of King Kong became unmistakable. On August 4th, the Inverness Courier published an astonishing letter from a Londoner named George Spicer. He had, he said, recently spotted a strange creature while driving along the shore of Loch Ness with his wife. His description of their spectacular sighting in broad daylight changed the legend forever. I saw the nearest approach to a dragon or prehistoric animal that I have ever seen in my life. It crossed my road about 50 yards ahead and appeared to be carrying a small lamb or animal of some kind. It seemed to have a long neck which moved up and down, in the manner of a scenic railway, and the body was fairly big, with a high back. Whereas the few previous witnesses had reported mere splashes or humps in the water, Spicer claimed a close-up view of a long-necked creature that could have been lifted right off of King Kong's Skull Island. And that, I believe, is exactly what happened. Among the most memorable scenes in King Kong is a night attacked by a long-necked water monster. As crewmen from the Venture raft tensely cross a fog-shrouded lake in pursuit of the abducted heroine, something sinister stirs in the water. A dark swan-like neck arcs out of the water and then slides back out of sight. The men peer through the dense fog when suddenly the looming neck attacks out of the darkness. The raft is overturned, spilling the men into the lake. In a series of dramatic shots, the huge, plesiosaur-like animal plucks men out of the water and kills them. This creature, with its rounded back, arched neck and small head is essentially identical to the plesiosaur-like popular Nessie that would grow out of Spicer's story. As the remaining Venture crewmen scramble to the seeming safety of the shore, they learn a terrible truth. The creature is not an aquatic plesiosaur, but a Diplodocus-like sauropod. The monster pursues the men onto land, and at this point, Spicer's sighting snaps sharply into focus. Spicer almost exactly recreated this scene. Spicer's creature crossed the road from left to right, just as the Diplodocus on land crosses the movie screen. As Spicer's beast crossed the road, we could see a very long neck which moved rapidly up and down in curves. The body then came into view. For its part, the somewhat implausibly writhing neck of the film's dinosaur enters first, followed by its huge body. The movie's creature gives the impression of having gray, elephant-like skin. Spicer's creature had gray skin, like a dirty elephant or a rhinoceros. The Loch Ness beast is of roughly similar size to the movie monster. It was big enough to have upset our car. I estimated that the creature's length to be about 25 to 30 feet. Finally, there is the troublesome description in Spicer's letter to the Inverness Courier that the monster appeared to be carrying a small lamb or animal of some kind. This appears to be a direct description of the last shot in King Kong's sauropod scene. Reaching into a tree, the dinosaur grabs a surviving crew member in its mouth and shakes him. In a shot that exactly matches Spicer's sketch, the doomed man looks exactly like a small lamb or animal of some kind in the monster's mouth. What we are left with is familiar to critical researchers of other paranormal topics, such as UFOs. A feedback loop among popular entertainment, news media, and paranormal belief. The Loch Ness Monster grew out of an existing genre of fictional encounters between modern humans and prehistoric creatures. Audiences for the hit silent film The Lost World watched a Diplodocus rampage through the streets of London, and those for King Kong saw another stop-motion sauropod dinosaur attack a raft full of men. These fictional stories prepared the public imagination to accept similar true stories that the press happily publicized. The press hype ensured further public interest, which inevitably generated more reports. Triggered by the Spicer case, a wave of new sighting reports poured in. The sheer number of accounts not only seemed to show that the monster was real, but also exposed a critical flaw in the newly minted legend. There is one vital question regarding it which must always cause warrantable doubt, one writer nailed it in 1938. Why have we heard of it only within the last 5 years or so, when there is no authenticated record of its existence in the centuries which have gone? This article was adapted from Abominable Science by Donald Prothero and Daniel Loxton. Over on the Health and Science page, Mars Supervolcanic Past. Ancient Mars had at least four supervolcanoes that violently expelled 1,000 times more lava and material than Mount St. Helens did in 1980. Planetary scientists studying photographs of craters on northern Mars recently realized they weren't created by meteor impacts, but are the collapsed remains of massive volcanoes. One of the craters, named Eden Patera, is a mile deep and 43 miles wide. More than 3.5 billion years ago, It was the site of a huge explosion that spewed billions of tons of lava, gas, and ash into the air that spread over much of the planet, covering it with a fine-grained dust. Instead of forming a cone, supervolcanoes explode underground and create gigantic depressions when they stop ejecting material. They were common on early Earth, helping to shape the geology and climate. In some cases, the greenhouse gases heated the atmosphere. In others, the ash blocked sunlight, cooling it. This is a totally new kind of process that we hadn't thought about for Mars, and it changes the way we view the evolution of the planet, study author Joseph Mikulski said of the Planetary Science Institute, tells CNN.com. Experts say it's unclear whether the volcanoes would have made ancient Mars more or less hospitable to life. Why novels make you nicer. To become a nicer, more empathetic person, pick up a good novel. New research proves what any English literature teacher could tell you. Reading fiction enables people to better understand other people's feelings and perspectives. Psychologists at the New School for Social Research ask people between the ages of 18 and 75 to read 10 to 15 pages of either literary fiction, including short stories by Anton Chekhov and Don DeLillo, popular fiction, including A Potboiler by Danielle Steele, or nonfiction articles from Smithsonian Magazine. Then they tested the subject's ability to look at pictures of people's eyes and faces and tell what emotions those pictures were feeling. The researchers found that the subjects who read the literary works scored much higher on the test than the other readers, suggesting that within just a few minutes, the stories had heightened their emotional intelligence. That's likely because literary fiction forces you as a reader to contribute your own interpretations, to reconstruct the mind of the character, study author Emmanuel Castano tells USA Today. That, in turn, may make readers better at empathizing with others and navigating complex social situations in real life. And the health scare of the week, stresses link to dementia. Experiencing stressful events in midlife makes you more likely to develop dementia later, BBCnews.com reports. Swedish researchers recruited 800 middle-aged women ages 38 and up and followed them for nearly 40 years, checking in to see whether they experienced any stressful life events, such as a divorce, the death of a spouse, caring for a sick relative, or unemployment. They found that for every stressful event the woman faced in midlife, the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease increased by 20%, regardless of how well they appeared to cope with the setbacks. Experts say the findings probably also hold true for men. This is the best evidence by far to date linking psychosocial stressors with dementia, says Robert S. Wilson, an Alzheimer's researcher at Rush University Medical Center. Previous research has suggested that stress hormones could contribute to the buildup of proteins that are found in the brains of people with dementia. Wilson says the findings suggest that stress reduction techniques should become part of routine health care. On our Talking Points page, the Republicans, how bad is the political damage? The deadlock in Washington is killing the Republican Party, said Joshua Green in BusinessWeek.com. Just 28% of Americans now have a favorable view of the Republicans, according to Gallup. That's a 10-point drop from only a month ago, and the lowest rating for any party in more than three decades. Even big business is souring on the GOP, complaining that it is being held hostage by a small band of rabid Tea Party rebels who are willing to do anything, including tank the economy, in their holy war against Obamacare. Republicans are not the party of business anymore, said Robert Shapiro, chairman of the economic advisory firm Sonicon. They're the party of anti-government. With Republicans badly splintered, the party could be headed toward electoral irrelevance, said John Judas in NewRepublic.com. Its more pragmatic leaders don't dare defy the anti-Washington, anti-immigration, and anti-big business populism of the Tea Party, which is intense in its commitment, but ultimately limited in its appeal. If the party's brand becomes synonymous with the radical right, it will start losing districts that Republicans and polling experts regard as safe, and the GOP will be crippled, not just in the 2014 and 2016 elections, but for decades to come. To survive, Republicans have but one choice: throw the Tea Party out, said Daniel Altman in foreignpolicy.com. The expulsion of extremists like Texas Senator Ted Cruz would be a political earthquake that would capture Americans' attention for weeks on end. A reinvigorated Republican Party, headed by centrists like New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, would no longer have its low tax and small government message polluted by anti-gay, anti-immigrant, and anti-poor rhetoric. Right now, extremism contaminates the whole Republican brand, said David Frum in CNN.com. In recent years, the party has lost half a dozen winnable Senate seats thanks to the nomination of Tea Party extremists like Missouri's Todd Akin. Next time Cruz and his allies try to blackmail the party and the country, Republican leaders should say, "So sad you feel that way. Don't let the door hit you on the way out." This is pure centrist fantasy, said Nate Cohn in NewRepublic.com. The Tea Party is not some small fringe element of the Republican coalition. Tea Partiers make up 49% of the GOP's primary electorate and 37% of Republican and Republican-leaning voters. The GOP establishment may not look like these passionate rabble-rousers, but the party couldn't survive without them, and knows it. Besides, the pundits are overstating the Republicans' troubles, said Nate Silver in Grantland.com. Remember Benghazi, the IRS scandal, President Obama's missteps on Syria? They were hyped as game-changing political moments by the news media. Yet they were quickly forgotten when the news cycle moved on to the next story. By the time the 2014 midterms roll around, some new issue will be getting all the attention, and the recent shutdown crisis will be all but forgotten. You're underestimating the depth of the Tea Partiers' fanaticism, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. These radicals simply refuse to believe that Obama is the nation's legitimate president, and will very likely go on trying to nullify the results of Democratic elections and congressional votes, no matter how much damage it does to our economy and America's credit rating. Republicans have become structurally dysfunctional, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. Rather than accept their defeat on defunding Obamacare, the Tea Partiers will likely demand another insane shutdown when the next budget crisis and debt ceiling arrive in early 2014, thus reminding voters of their recklessness. That will destroy any hopes Republicans had of retaking the Senate next year, and it could cost them House seats too. Nonetheless, Republican leaders just can't declare war on their own base, said Russ Duthat at the New York Times. Instead, Republicans need to integrate the positive aspects of the new populism, its hostility to Wall Street and Washington, It's championing of the middle class with the prudence and realism of the party's establishment. Obama actually serves as a good model. In 2007 and 2008, he managed to channel the zeal of the anti-war left without being defined by its excesses. Right now, however, conservative extremists still think they can force Democrats to surrender and make Obamacare disappear. It may take another crushing election loss or two to wake the GOP from this fever dream. And a few notes as we wind down our time this evening. The current John Roberts-led U.S. Supreme Court is actually less activist than any Supreme Court in the last 60 years, if activism is defined by a willingness to strike down laws. The Warren Court, 1953 to 69, invalidated laws in 7% of its cases. The Berger Court, 1969 to 86, in 9%. The Rehnquist Court, 1986 to 2005, in 6.4%. And the Roberts Court, since 2005, in just 4%. The flood of aid and aid workers that followed the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 helped to boost the average Afghan's life expectancy from 42 years in 2004 to 62 in 2010. It's not just the American people who have been getting fatter. Their animals have been, too. The National Pet Obesity Survey recently reported that more than 50% of cats and dogs, that's more than 80 million pets, are overweight or obese. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.